Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer, producer and host of this program, and it's good to be with you. Before she became an attorney, Laura Pontius got a lot of questions about immigration law.
And I'd look at the document and I'd say, you know, I can read it. I see that it's in English, but this seems like a different language to me. I cannot understand what this document is.
What is our current immigration system like? And how did we get here? What are some of the pathways to lawful status? And how have they changed during the Trump presidency? Who are some of the largest immigrant populations in the U.S.? And what are some of the biggest misconceptions about them? Intro to Immigration Law and Policy, from the Values, Ideas, and the Arts series at Manchester University. Laura Pontius will be introduced in a moment. Please enjoy the show.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you all for being here. My name is Ahmed Abdelmajid. I'm an assistant dean with the pharmacy programs in Fort Wayne. And it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker for this afternoon, my friend Laura Pontius. Laura Pontius is an immigration attorney in Northern Indiana who handles immigration cases for individuals, families, businesses, churches, and nonprofits. In her role with the Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic, she provides Know Your Rights legal sessions for the immigrant community throughout Northern Indiana, as well as legal education seminars for the non-immigrant community. Laura is a member of the American Immigration Lawyers Association and also serves on various local and national boards, including the Fort Wayne Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic and the Immigration Alliance. She graduated from the University of Wyoming College of Law, and before that earned her Bachelor of Arts in International Studies and Religious Studies from Indiana University in Bloomington. Please help me welcome Laura Pontius.
Thank you so much. Thank you for being here. I am an immigration attorney, and I've been practicing for about 8 years now, and I wanted to give you a little bit of background as to why I got into immigration law, and hopefully that will help you understand kind of the type of things that I'm doing now with my practice. So I used to be an ESL teacher, so I taught English as a second language when I was living in Wyoming, and I taught a family literacy course where we would separate the parents and the children into two different rooms and do various activities with them. And then we'd bring them back together and do a family activity all in English. After the class, I would always have a very long line of students lining up to ask me questions that were not about the English language. They were always about immigration law. And they would bring these documents to me and they'd show me the documents and say, well, what does this mean? I got this notice from this federal agency. What does it mean? And I'd look at the document and I'd say, you know, I can read it. I see that it's in English, but this seems like a different language to me. I cannot understand what this document is. So after much thinking and processing, I realized that I would be a better advocate if I could understand the legalese for the immigrant community. So I went to law school, was able to start an immigration and human rights clinic while I was there out in Wyoming. And the rest is history. I've been practicing immigration law ever since. So I do work with an agency called Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic. In the role that I have with them, I do mostly public education events like this, but we also do Know Your Rights sessions for our immigrant community here in Northern Indiana. There have been a lot of changes that we'll cover today during the presentation, and so we're trying to get that information out to the immigrant community so that they understand what the actual changes have been and they aren't kind of led astray by a lot of the rumors that have been going around. So we will start and we'll talk about what our current immigration law system is like, what some of the pathways to lawful status look like. Then we will move on and go to recent changes that have been happening in the last few years. You've probably been hearing on the news, reading in articles that you've been seeing on social media that there have been significant changes. We're going to cover a few of them. We don't have time to go through everything that has changed in the last few years. Then we'll take a look at immigrants here in the United States. Who are immigrants? Where do immigrants come from? What do they do when they're here in the United States? And then we'll address some common misconceptions that we hear in the news media. When we look at the different types of immigration statuses that someone can hold, the first is undocumented, and this is really what we like to call without status. It's not a status at all. And a quick note here on terminology, some individuals use the word illegal or illegal aliens or illegals. plural to describe this group of people. And in the immigrant advocate community, we choose not to use that term. We feel it is somewhat dehumanizing to individuals. We don't think humans can be legal or illegal. They could just be documented or undocumented here in the United States. This is not a lawful status. Most people who are in the undocumented category are there not because they want to be, but because there's no other option for them. They aren't qualified, they're not eligible for another lawful path. Another status that someone could hold is a humanitarian status. So the most common is to be a refugee or an asylee. Also trafficking victims, victims of crime fit into this category. Another common category or a status is a non-immigrant status. This is different than undocumented or without status. A non-immigrant is someone who does not wish to immigrate here. So they are coming temporarily. So you have business, visitors, tourists, students fall into this category. They are not immigrating. They're non-immigrants. Another category, another status someone could hold is to be an immigrant. So this is someone who is intending to immigrate here. The most common term here is green card holder. We also refer to it as lawful permanent residence. Someone who is in this category has been lawfully admitted to the United States. They're legally able to live here, legally able to work here. Individuals in this category cannot vote, and they cannot run for public office. And there is always a chance that they can be deported. So green card holders are not isolated from deportation. The last status is to be a U.S. citizen. And this is individuals who have been green card holders for a certain number of years are then eligible to apply to become citizens. This isn't all the statuses someone could hold, but this is a more accurate look at some of the common statuses that an individual could apply for. Each one of these is very nuanced and complex, has a variety of different requirements and eligibility rules that are associated with them. We've covered now the main types of status that someone can hold, but how someone uses that status to lead to a green card is a different story. So again, there are lots of different ways that someone could get a green card, but we're going to talk about these main categories. So we have employment-based pathway, a family-based pathway, humanitarian, and that again is refugees, asylees, trafficking victims. Diversity lottery is a pathway that can lead to a green card. And the fun category of other, which includes a lot that we won't go into because there are too many. This process is very long. It takes a long time. It's very complex. So the attorney fees tend to be very, very high for immigrants applying under this category. Within employment-based immigration, if someone is wanting to get a green card based on their job or their experience, preference in this category is given to those that are highly skilled. So we're looking at people with high levels of education, extraordinary ability, outstanding professors, researchers, scientists, doctors, kind of the top of the top, people who are at the top of their field. Those visas are more readily available for individuals like that. But there's a category called alien of extraordinary ability. And this is a term that is really funny for me. This is actually from our federal law. For me, it conjures up images of aliens with really, really high levels of laser beams and that kind of thing. We're actually talking about humans here. We're not talking about aliens. When I've done cases for alien of extraordinary ability in the past, they really are individuals that are beyond, you know, what we assume someone to have, you know, their skills. One individual was from Russia that I worked with, and he identified a way to discover cancer cells using gamma radiation rays, certain colors. And yeah, for me, it was way above what I could, understand. But we were able to petition the government and say, we want this individual here in the United States because we want to be able to cure cancer at a faster rate. And he won his green card. So he's now here in the United States researching and continuing on in his path. Visas in this category are also granted to people with a lot of money. So immigrant investors can apply for a green card. They have to have a minimum of $500,000. The more you have, the more likely you are to get the green card. So in the last maybe 5 years or so, I wouldn't consider filing an immigrant investor case with someone who had just $500,000. I think that probably wouldn't qualify. And then also within this employment-based category, we have low-skilled immigrant visas. So these are agriculture workers, tourism industry, people working in restaurants, those kinds of industries. Unfortunately, these visas are the hardest to get, and there are not very many of them. Congress sets the level every year of visas that are available in this category, and every year there are more applications than there are visas. So for an employer who's looking to go through this process, number one, they have to work with the Department of Labor, which is a nightmare. Number two, they have to pay $15,000 to $20,000 just to submit the application. Number three, they're not guaranteed to get the visas. So a lot of employers are discouraged from using this process. For a lot of employers, it's just easier to hire people who are not documented and, you know, to do it the unlawful way, which is unfortunate. Another path that somebody could take to get a green card is through family. So there are two status types that are able to petition for family members overseas, and this is a lawful permanent resident or someone who has a green card, or a U.S. citizen. A green card holder can petition for their spouse or their unmarried son or daughter. A U.S. citizen has a few more options, so they can petition for their son, daughter, siblings, their spouse, and their parents. It's important to note for a U.S. citizen to be able to petition for their parents, they have to be 21. There is also a program that is involved within the family-based route that's called the Visa Bulletin. So this is basically a system where our Congress has set the levels of visas that are given to any one nationality based on how many people are applying from that country. So for example, countries like India, Mexico, China, Korea, Philippines, these are considered oversubscribed countries. There are so many people applying from those countries that the wait tends to be much longer. So a sibling of a U.S. citizen, if they filed right now, they would have a 14-year wait in order to even be considered to come to the United States. Also within this path, there are always eligibility barriers that exist for someone. So they may qualify, they may have the right kind of relationship with a U.S. citizen or green card holder, but let's say they have a bad financial background, or they aren't highly skilled, or they have certain health issues that make them ineligible to immigrate. So these are always concerns that people are looking at when they're looking at applying under this pathway. Another pathway that is that can lead to a green card is the diversity lottery. This is something that was created in the 1990s by Congress to address the imbalance. Congress noticed, you know, we have people coming from the same countries over and over and over, and there are many countries that are underrepresented. So they created a lottery system for those countries. So if you lived in that country, if you live in that country, you can apply to get your name drawn out of a hat. It's random. It's, you know, very much so a lottery, and it's free to apply. If you are chosen, you still do face background checks and eligibility barriers, but just the option of being chosen to apply for a green card is a significant benefit for a lot of people. The odds are really bad, depending on how many people enter. In 2017, it was 22.4 million people. This is something that when we're counseling clients, if they're not eligible for any of the other lawful paths, we always tell people, put your name in the hat for the diversity lottery, because it's free and you just never know when your name is going to be drawn. Okay, and then the other pathway that we're going to talk about that could lead to a green card is through the humanitarian path. So I did mention earlier that victims of crime and trafficking victims can qualify here. We're not going to cover those. We're going to talk more about refugees and asylees, because I think it's a little bit more timely right now with what's happening. This is the only excerpt of law that I have in the whole presentation, but I think it's important that we read through this. This is the federal definition of what a refugee is here in the United States. So the term refugee means any person who's outside any country, that person's nationality, and they're unable or unwilling to return to and unable or unwilling to avail themselves of the protection of that country because of persecution, and this is in the past, or a well-founded fear of persecution in the future, on the basis of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. Now, this definition is codified in our federal law, but the United States is also subject to international law, and it's the same definition. So we are not only required to use this definition by our federal law, but also the international law that it's at play. The number of refugees and asylees that are admitted every year, it's a number that changes from year to year, and I have a chart later on that we'll look at the different refugee numbers, but the U.S. president sets the level. This current fiscal year is the lowest level ever in history that the U.S. admission level has been set. So an asylum seeker is someone who travels from their country of origin to the United States. Once that person is on the U.S. soil, they make a claim for asylum. At that point, their claim for asylum is being processed or adjudicated. So our federal agencies are looking to see, do they qualify? Do they meet that definition? Have they suffered persecution in the past? Are they likely to in the future? Now, a refugee is someone who is still in their country of origin. Sometimes they've relocated based on refugee camps and where those camps are located. But within the refugee camp, they work with the UNHCR, which is the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and they apply to be resettled as a refugee in the United States. This process is long and it's complex. There are several rounds of background checks and vetting and interviews and background checks and vetting and interviews that individuals go through. They are approved still in their country of origin or wherever they are applying from. When they travel to the United States, they've already been approved and they're able to apply for a green card once they arrive here. So there are some differences between an asylum seeker, is someone who's come to the United States to lodge their claim and have the claim processed here, whereas a refugee had their claim processed overseas. And then a migrant is someone who is leaving their country for a reason that is not related to that definition we looked at. So most commonly, migrants are leaving for economic reasons. They're leaving because of natural disasters. But as you'll see, that those factors don't play into the definition of refugee. So they won't qualify to become a refugee if they're just leaving because they need a job or they've left because there was a flood. If we want to talk about what does the sample green card journey look like, what does it look like for someone to walk one of these paths and go through the process? Well, it's very different. No journey is the same. Every person's background matters a lot, so their country of origin, their age, their family relationships, some of the other factors we've talked about. All these factors can affect whether someone is able to obtain the visa or not. Because there's not one specific example that represents this process, I'm going to show a cartoon that represents a typical process. And you're welcome to Google this on your phones if you'd like so that you can actually read it. Just Google what part of legal immigration don't you understand. But essentially this cartoon shows a gentleman who is trying to navigate a few different paths. So this is not everything we've talked about and it's not all the options that someone could use. But this person is trying to navigate the different, eligibility criteria. And you can see, at this part, it says, like, are you skilled? And it's yes or no. Well, no, then you're not able to come. And in the majority of the scenarios, the gentleman ends up with a beard, which is the orange thing, and long hair because he's been waiting 10 to 20 years in most of the categories. So now that we've talked a little bit about the basics of our current immigration system, we're going to cover again the most significant changes that have happened. You're probably going to notice that we're not going to cover the pathways that we've talked about or the types of status. It's because those things haven't changed. So immigration law in the United States is created by Congress, and the current version that we have, the Immigration and Nationality Act, it was created in 1965. So when I'm writing a legal brief, I'm using law that dates back to 1965 right now. So the things that have changed you know, it's more based on policy and how that law is implemented and enforced. The actual laws themselves haven't been changing for a very long time. So we're going to start with DACA, and before we talk about the changes, I'm just going to go through the basics of what DACA is, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, just so we're all on the same page and can understand some of the implications of the changes that have happened. DACA, if we look at what DACA is, it's not a law that was created. It was an executive order that was issued in 2012. The order basically said that certain young individuals who came to the United States as children and meet 7 or 8 guidelines, they can request this program, deferred action, for 2 years, and they can apply for renewals. The great thing about this program is that it enabled people to apply for work authorization, which is, it's a huge benefit to have the lawful ability to work, to be able to show someone, look, I have a Social Security card now, you know, the federal government has said I am eligible to work. Deferred action is what we call prosecutorial discretion. So officially, individuals with deferred action, they do not have status. They are undocumented individuals. So they would qualify for deportation. The discretion that's being used here is by the government saying, you know, in our great and wonderful discretion, we're choosing not to take action on your case. We're choosing to defer action and not deport you for this period of 2 years and for however many times you successfully renew. It's important to note that deferred action did not provide lawful status for people. These individuals are still undocumented and still face a lot of fear and anxiety around their status. For first-time requesters, it's important to note that this program, you're no longer able to apply first time for it. We're only seeing that they're accepting renewals right now. But just so we know, individuals who were applying for DACA for the first time, they had to be under 31 as of June 2012. They had to come to the United States before they were 16. They had to be continuously residing in the United States, and this means never traveling outside of the country. From 2007 up until the present time. They had to be physically present on the date that this executive order was announced and at the time that they submit their DACA application. They had to be without lawful status when they submitted their application. The individuals had to be either currently in school, they had to have obtained a diploma from high school or a GED, or they could be an honorably discharged veteran of the armed forces. And they had to have a pretty clean criminal background. So no felonies, no significant misdemeanors, and you couldn't also have 3 low-level misdemeanors. So if individuals qualified, based on that, they would submit an application. If they were approved, they were entitled to a work authorization document for 2 years, and then they could submit it for renewal. So what has happened with DACA? In September of 2017, the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, he announced we're canceling DACA. What happened after this was there were multiple rounds of lawsuits that are still pending, some of them, and they were filed on both sides of the issue. So there were immigrant advocates who filed lawsuits saying, this is a benefit that you've taken from the DACA population. You know, it's almost 1 million people, and you can't just take it away. And then there were people that were on the other side, mostly states, that were suing to kind of put pressure on the presidential administration to really cancel the program. Instead of just giving this timeline, they said, we want the program to end, so we're suing, asking you to end the program. There are a lot of different results around the country from these various lawsuits. The most common one is that courts decided to order a halt to the cancellation. So the program itself is still alive. It exists in a very different form than it did a few years ago. And most recently, the Supreme Court decided not to address this issue in the current term. So we're still in a little bit of a legal limbo with the DACA program. There are some things that are black and white, but there's a lot of gray that exists with DACA. Part of the DACA program was advanced parole, and this is basically a travel document that individuals who had DACA They could apply to travel out of the country and come back. Typically, when someone without status does that, it triggers a lot of different immigration penalties. So the advanced parole is a very important part of the DACA program. It is no longer available. So individuals who are here with DACA that have urgent needs to travel overseas to visit grandparents who are dying or parents who are sick, they are not able to do that at this time. I would encourage you, if you have friends or if you know someone who has DACA, to sign up on United We Dream. It's a great website and it's youth-led, and they do a really good job of monitoring the changes up to the minute. So I am signed up on their website and I get information from them before any of my legal legal organizations send it to me. So they are very, very quick. They'll update you with the, you know, up to the minute information on DACA. If someone would like to renew their DACA program, their grant of deferred action, you can submit it now if you qualify. So there are three things that the government will look at to see if you're eligible. First, they want to make sure you didn't leave the United States after this certain date. They want to see that you're continuously residing here in the United States and that you don't have a criminal background. So it's the same thing again. You're looking at felonies, significant misdemeanors, or three or more low-level misdemeanors. Okay, so those are the DACA changes. Another thing that has changed in the last few years has been worksite enforcement. So to give you a little bit of background, under George W. Bush, the focus of that administration with worksite enforcement was to do these large-scale raids of bigger industries, so meatpacking plants, manufacturing facilities, large-scale agriculture operations. The idea was to get really good optics and arrest hundreds of undocumented workers at one time. So that administration was kind of known for those large-scale raids. Under President Obama, the focus was more on what we call desk audits, so they're looking at the employer more, looking at their I-9 forms, making sure that the employees that were employed there were, you know, given the right kind of rights, looking at different audits of employers, and then imposing really, really high fines. So some of the highest fines ever imposed on employers for employing undocumented workers were given during the Obama administration. Our current administration, the focus is on both. We've seen a large uptick in both these kind of highly militarized raids of, you know, work sites, but also we've seen a lot of desk audits where the administration is looking at employers and making sure they're complying. These raids have been happening all over the U.S. It's not just in California and New York where some of the highest immigrant populations are. There were two actually last year in Ohio, which is really close to us. The work site raids are incredibly terrifying for the immigrant community. They tear parents away from children. So imagine if you're a child and you come home from school and your parents aren't there and you have no idea why your parents aren't there. You have no idea that they were taken from their work site, from their place of employment, and they're now in a detention facility and they could only make one phone call. And so that phone call is typically to their attorney to help advocate for them. So it's really, really difficult on families. Psychologically, there have been a lot of studies that show these types of raids are very, very harmful. They, you know, individuals experience high levels of trauma as the raid is occurring. I mean, if you imagine working in your industry that you've been working in for decades and your employer is nice to you and you respect your employer, and all of a sudden one day people come in SWAT gear with helmets on and huge weapons and bulletproof vests. That is incredibly terrifying for individuals to go through. And then these raids also really destabilize local economies and local communities. A lot of the employers who employ undocumented workers and are advocates for their employees, they have lodged a lot of complaints about what this does to their bottom line and how economically this is really affecting their ability to be productive and to produce the different items that they're in charge of. So it's not just enforcement and immigration violators who are facing changes in the last few years, but also those who are applying through the various lawful paths, you know, that we talked about. People can use employment or family or diversity lottery. Individuals using those paths are facing a lot of different challenges right now, too. So first, wait times have increased across the board, but most significantly for people who are applying for naturalization. So it used to be that, you know, if you submitted an application for naturalization, you could expect in 7 to 12 months to get an answer. Now it's looking more like 12 to 18 months. You're having to wait to get an answer on that. Approval rates for visas have gone up a lot, or gone down a lot. The specific visa we've noticed the most significant change in is the H-1B visa. This is one you might have heard about. A lot of industries are very reliant on H-1B workers. They are individuals who have a bachelor's degree and are working as accountants or tech industry. They're working as computer programmers. This visa, there have been a lot of changes to the program, and so the approval rate has dropped a lot. We've also seen that the administration now requires face-to-face interviews for every person who's applying for any immigration benefit. So it used to be that someone who was renewing a visa or just going home to get their visa extended and coming back, you know, they didn't have to sit down with an officer face-to-face and do an interview. Every single person now that's applying has to do that. I was just with an officer a few weeks ago with a client, and she made this off-the-cuff comment about how your president now requires face-to-face interviews for everyone, so my job is much more fun. I mean, she was just very, very annoyed at how difficult this has gotten for her. So it's making things administratively very difficult for everyone. There's also been a pretty big change to the amount and types of information that people have to provide for when they apply for a visa. So in the past, when we would apply for immigrant visas, the government didn't really look that much at social media, at what people would post online, what they would say, pictures, those kinds of things. Now they are required to look at social media, and we're seeing denials based on things that are somewhat questionable. So what we've been advising our clients is that if you know that you're going to be applying for a visa, please watch what you say on social media and be careful about what you're posting pictures of on social media. We've also seen just an overall increase to denials and the agencies not really allowing people to fix common errors. So in the past, if we would submit an application, you know, most applications are about this big, one file, we'd send it in the mail, and the government would go through it and they'd say, oh, you forgot to include this person's birth certificate. So they would just send us a note and said, oh, we're requesting this extra evidence that wasn't in the original filing. They'd give, 3 months to do that. So now, if they get the application and the birth certificate is missing or some other document that they want, they will just deny the application on its face. And if that person who was applying, if they are undocumented or without status, that denial begins their deportation process. So it's a really significant change. It's made the way I practice law very different now under this administration. I will not submit an application that I don't feel confident about. Someone might look good on paper, it might look like they qualify, but there are some factors that make me feel like there are some questions. I just won't submit it. I've been telling people to wait and wait maybe until a few years later if they can. Okay, so some of the other changes we're seeing is with the humanitarian program, asylum and refugees. The procedures at the border, I think we've probably all seen that on the news, that there have been a lot of discussion about what's happening at the border, people coming to request asylum. So this has prompted a change in how people apply once they reach the border. So in the past, individuals who come to the United States and are on U.S. soil, they make their claim for asylum, they usually would remain in the U.S. while that asylum claim was pending, while it would make its way through the courts and the various agencies. The current administration would like it to be that people stay in Mexico while their claims are pending. This is very concerning, especially for individuals who are claiming asylum from Mexico. You can imagine, especially if someone has like a political opinion asylum claim, if we're telling them, you know, okay, we'll listen to your claim, we'll let it navigate our courts, but you stay in the country that you're scared to be in while we're processing it. It's very alarming, a lot of anxiety for asylum applicants over this policy. Another thing is at the immigration court level, there have been changes. So you might have heard about the backlogs that the current immigration court faces. It's very true. The U.S. immigration court faces about 800,000 cases that are backlogged in the system and waiting. It used to be a few years ago, if we would file an asylum claim and it would be, you know, in front of the court, our clients would not get a hearing for 3 to 6 years. So during that 3 to 6 years, they are in legal limbo, stuck waiting. Our government would allow them to work, would allow them to apply for a work authorization document, which is something that is codified in law. It's part of our federal law that they're able to do that. But the current administration has changed the processing. So they're saying, you know, from this date on, from this last fall, we're going to process whoever files, we're going to process you right away, because they're trying to attempt to get them in and out before they could apply for work authorization. So this has complicated things for asylum applicants and also asylum attorneys. The cases are very, very difficult to win in court. They require a lot of evidence, a lot of prep time, a lot of expert witnesses, and it's very difficult to put all of that together in a matter of weeks. In the past, you know, people would have months or years to do that, and they no longer have that. We're also seeing intensified screening for refugee applicants. We talked earlier about when someone applies to be a refugee from their native country, they're in the UNHCR refugee camps, they're sitting in there waiting, you know, they go through this extreme vetting process. Well, that has gotten a lot more extreme lately. It's slowed everything down. The agencies are monitoring a lot of different types of information. It's taking them longer to process that. And then refugee admission numbers have gone down quite a bit. So in 2017, the cap was set at 50,000 and 53,000 were admitted. Currently, we have set the cap, the president set the cap at 30,000, which is the lowest in history that the U.S. has ever accepted. And this is at a time where globally, the global refugee population is at historic highs. So we have historic highs happening in our world, and our country is accepting historic low numbers of refugees. Another thing that has changed is the incarceration. So in 2018, ICE detained 7,500 more people than they were allowed to detain based on their funding. So they, you know, in a year, that means about 400,000 people were incarcerated. The jails are overcrowded, and a lot of these policies that are changing so rapidly, all of that leaves the immigrants that are detained with very few rights. We're seeing sexual abuse rates skyrocket. Involuntary labor is happening here on U.S. soil in immigration detention centers. And we've seen pretty serious violations of allowing people access to their attorneys. Okay, so now we're going to shift and look at who are immigrants here in the United States. Where do immigrants travel from, and what do immigrants do in the United States? So who is an immigrant? Well, we all are, unless your family was native to this continent. At one point, there was an immigration story. And if you don't know yours, I would highly encourage you to discover it. It's a really interesting process. My parents and I are going through the process right now. We spit into the little tube and sent it through the mail, and we're discovering a lot of really interesting things about our family history. And I think that you probably would enjoy that process too, maybe not the spitting in the tube. But immigrants are fathers, mothers, husbands, wives. They're farmers, they're doctors, tech industry workers, artists, entrepreneurs. And if we look at the number of immigrants that have come throughout history, we can see that it's shifted based on different economic seasons, different wars, legislation changes. Currently, the percentage of the U.S. population that immigrants make up is 13.7%. The highest it's ever been is 14.7. So we're not quite there, but we're close right now. If we look at where immigrants come from, the top 10 largest groups in the U.S., so you can see Mexico is there, Korea, India, Guatemala. El Salvador, the DR, Cuba, China, Vietnam. And then we can also look locally. This was taken from a study done by New American Economy, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But they looked at our specific area, northeastern Indiana, and they found that the top five countries here are Mexico, Myanmar, India, Guatemala, and China. What do immigrants do in the United States? So currently there are 26.8 million employed foreign-born workers. And the largest share of that number, of the 20, was 27 million, so it's 32%. They work in management and professional industries and other kinds of related occupations. We're going to talk briefly about the top misconceptions that we might hear. You might have been hearing a lot of these on the news media or on social media and some of the articles you've read. We'll talk about the get in line argument. Why can't undocumented immigrants just become documented? You may have heard some people say most immigrants are criminals, immigrants take American jobs, or they don't pay taxes and they use public benefits. So with the get in line argument, if we look at the history of U.S. immigration law, before 1924, the lawful way to come was to get on a ship and come. There wasn't a visa that was required. You didn't have to submit an application. You just traveled and arrived and you were here in the United States. Now in 1924, it's when Ellis Island closed. So at that point on, visas started to be required, and the entry applicants had different requirements they were dealing with. Sometimes people say, get in line. Well, we don't have that physical line anymore. Ellis Island is closed. But we have a metaphorical line, and it's the visa bulletin that we talked about earlier. This is where the Congress sets the levels based on the countries that are have the highest levels of applicants. You look at India, Mexico, Philippines. These are some of the countries that have the highest number of applicants. So the line that applicants would stand in from these countries tends to be longer. So if you look at that F4 category, that is for brothers and sisters of a U.S. citizen. Okay, so let's imagine you're a U.S. citizen and you want your brother to come live in the United States with you. So if your brother, if you filed your application in January of 1996, as of last month, he would be able to come. That was how long your brother would have to wait to come to the U.S. as a brother of a U.S. citizen. Some people ask the question, well, why can't the undocumented population just legalize? Why can't they just become citizens and submit their applications and pay the fees to do that? Well, there isn't just one path for everybody, as you know, because we've covered that. There are only a handful of types of path that people can be on, and they're not always eligible for these. So every person has a different background. They have different stories that make them eligible or ineligible for different pathways. They can't simply just apply for residency or citizenship unless they're eligible. And in fact, right now, it's somewhat dangerous to submit an application, as I was saying earlier, if they're not entirely 100% sure that they do fit those criteria. The other argument that we hear a lot is that most immigrants are criminals. They're here to rape us. They are drug traffickers. They are murderers. They're in gangs. I think that it's good to know that all humans commit crimes, regardless of your immigrant status or not. So it is true that some immigrants commit crimes, just like some Americans commit crimes, some people from Europe commit crimes. But the studies across the political spectrum, and there was just another one that came out last week, have been showing that immigrants commit crimes at much lower rates than the native-born U.S. population. They're also incarcerated at much lower rates than the native-born U.S. population. The FBI actually did a case study looking at the immigrant population between 1980 and 2016, and they compared it with the rate of violent crime during that same time period. And they found that there was a 118% increase to the immigrant population during these years, but that violent crime fell by 36%. So this is homicides, rapes, robberies, assaults. The worst of the worst was dropping as the immigrant population was rising. Another argument we hear a lot is that immigrants take American jobs. When you look at the effect of all immigrants on employment in the U.S., there is no evidence that immigrants take jobs from U.S.-born workers. And in fact, a recent study from Yale showed that immigration contributes to economic growth and the expansion of the labor market. If you look at some of the biggest companies operating in the world right now, you see that many of them have immigrant founders. So these companies founded by immigrants are literally creating thousands and thousands of jobs for American workers, not taking them away. Also, when we look at the claim that immigrants harm the U.S. economy, we can look at just one sector of agriculture and see that it's not the case. Immigrants account for 13% of the U.S. population, and they make up 17% of the total workforce here in the U.S. But they account for 73% of our agricultural labor force. So imagine if we didn't have immigrants working in this one industry, what would happen to our food prices and the availability to buy food at certain rates? Another misconception is that immigrants use public benefits and don't pay taxes. And in fact, undocumented immigrants are not eligible to use federal public benefits. So the individuals that are administering these programs, the Medicaid and other types of federal benefits, they are not allowed to give benefits to people who don't qualify. The qualifications are very clear, and if an individual doesn't have documentation to show, they are not eligible. Immigrants with lawful permanent residence, so someone with a green card, is eligible, but there are some restrictions on when they can start using them, so they have to wait until they have been a legal resident for 5 years before they start using them. Also, documented and undocumented immigrants pay more into the public benefit system than they take out. Immigrants regularly pay their taxes using I-10 numbers and are very religious about doing that every spring. And the IRS has said, you know, for decades, we want your money. We're not going to report you to the other agencies. And the IRS itself has reported the net gain that our public benefit system receives from the amount of taxes coming from people with I-10 numbers. The number I think that there is $11.74 billion that immigrants are paying into state and local economies every year. And again, remember, undocumented immigrants can't take from that system, so it's a huge net gain for our public benefits. In the end, if you hear a stat or a report that you are not sure is correct on the immigration issue, you know, if you're talking with friends or you see something on social media, I just encourage you to do your own research. And I have some resources here that are bipartisan that do a really good job of reporting data that is not leaning one side or the other, but it's just raw data to give people the facts that they need to evaluate the situation. The first is New American Economy. They collaborated with Welcoming Fort Wayne, Northeast Indiana Regional Partnership, Associated Churches, a few other organizations to make this happen. It's not cheap to pay the New American Economy to come and do this research on our community. And so we have now a really great, I think it's 5 or 6 page report on the number of immigrants that are in Northern Indiana, the economic benefits they bring, the jobs they do, the different countries they represent. So I'd encourage you to look at New American Economy, to look at this area or other areas that you're interested in. Another resource is the National Immigration Forum. Again, this is a bipartisan group. They tend to look more at the different industries. They look at the U.S. workforce and how immigration affects, the U.S. labor market. They have some pretty good infographics, so it's not super boring to read. It's a little more entertaining for your eye. And if you're wanting a podcast on immigration that is interesting and it doesn't contain yelling on the subject, the director of this organization, Ali Nourani, he has the most comforting voice and interviews some really interesting immigrants and has some really interesting stories across the nation. He's always traveling and he's in a different state almost every day covering the issue of immigration. So I encourage you to look at it. It's called Only in America is the podcast. The last resource is Migration Policy Institute, MPI. This is for those of you who are interested in lots of data and research that is not entertaining to the eye and is not colorful, but would be good bedtime reading. This agency does, you know, pretty lengthy research and reports. I would say they also have identified some really creative things to research that aren't necessarily in the mainstream media. So they'll look at immigrants, you know, how immigrants impact different industries in ways that other organizations aren't looking at.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Special thanks to Matt Unger and his team at Manchester University for providing the audio for this program. Our music is by Mark Waldick and Noah Campodonico. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. Until next time, thank you for listening.